You're listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick, sponsored by Philanthropic Impact.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen, wherever you are in the world. Welcome back to The Caring Economy with me, Toby Usnick. Each week on this show, we explore the intersection of business, technology, and social impact. And today we have a special guest who's leading the charge both in corporate social responsibility and community building. Joining us today is Nate Clark. He's the Global Director of Corporate Social Responsibility, or CSR, as we like to say. And he's the president of the John Deere Foundation, which I'm a very proud owner of several pieces of John Deere equipment. And as they say, nothing runs like a deer, and we're going to talk about that today. But first, Nate, welcome to The Caring Economy.
Thanks, Toby. I'm really thrilled to be here.
I've given my full disclosure so our audience knows I'm a loyalist. But Nate, we always ask our guests to give us a quick sort of like 2-3 minute summary of their life story, maybe where they were born, how they got where they got, any bumps or mentors or pivotal moments along the way.
Well, I'm happy to. And Toby, if I remember, you're a Midwesterner too?
By birth, yes, I am. Ohio.
For many of us at John Deere, we have a similar path to the company. And I'll give you a little bit of history. My family is originally from the Waterloo, Iowa area. And Waterloo is important for John Deere because in 1918, the company bought a gasoline engine and tractor company. And that was the start of us entering the tractor business. And so for those of us who are from the Waterloo region, John Deere is ever present. We see it in our fields. We see it in our communities, on our roads. And most of us have family members who've worked for the company. And I remember, my dad was in the military, so we moved all around. Mm-hmm. And over the summers, I would come back home and work on my grandparents' property. And I remember one day asking my grandmother quite vividly, I remember this, what are the best places to work? And my grandmother told me two answers. She said the post office, and then she also said John Deere's. After 20 years of being with the company, I have found out that my grandmother was right.
It is great. And I still think of it as quintessentially American, although global in your business. Your colors and your equipment just seem to pop on the horizon. You can see orange and yellow and other kinds of equipment out there. But I always think of John Deere as quintessential, almost like as American flag. So why don't you tell us a little bit about your whole experience with getting there, though. You moved, you said you were kind of an army brat, my words, not yours. When you said earlier before the interview, you went to school in Boston. So how did you get from Boston to John Deere?
Yeah, it's a great, it's a fun story. I love to share it. So when my dad retired from the military, we moved back to Iowa and I went to high school in Iowa. And at some point I decided I wanted to study philosophy. And at the time, Boston University pulled me in. Elie Wiesel, the Nobel Prize winning author of Night, drew me into that school and I studied there. And like many of us, I didn't know what to do after college. And so I applied to law school at the University of Iowa. The mountaintop for me has always been the University of Iowa. And so I was lucky enough to get in and meet my wife, who my future wife, and I clerked for a judge after I graduated, and we were lucky enough to get pregnant with my son, who's now 23, and at the University of Iowa College of Law. And I remember her saying, Nate, let's move back to Iowa and let's move to the Quad Cities. And I remember saying, well, what's in the Quad Cities? And she's like, don't worry about it. You'll get a job with a law firm and the rest will be history. And so we moved back, and as a lawyer, I actually was lucky enough to get John Deere as one of my clients.
Uh-huh.
And all of those memories from my grandmother of knowing that the grass was greener if you worked at John Deere, those came to mind. And many of us in this community have always looked up to John Deere as a perfect place to work. And I was lucky enough to get a job about 20 years ago. And since then, I tell this to young and new employees at John Deere all the time. In 10 years, you'll be in a job you never imagined. And John Deere has this great culture of putting people into different positions. Uh-huh. And I started as a lawyer. I did public affairs work. I sold forestry equipment. And then about a decade ago, I was thrilled to join the John Deere Foundation as the president. And then about 3 years ago, I was just thrilled to become the president of the foundation.
Wow. So you went into public affairs, which is a common route for lawyers in corporate lives. And then
yes,
you went to sales and then back to the foundation.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
You got the hard experience that you need frontline. That's great.
Yeah. And you know, one of the things that's, there are many special things about John Deere, but one of those is this belief that to understand the role that we play in the world in supporting customers who farm and harvest and build, is that you should have that experience with our customers and our dealers who serve them so beautifully. And so I was lucky enough to have that experience as part of my growth in the company.
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to our John Deere guy, Kim Keel in Red Hook, New York. He has been there. His family's been in. They've had two locations. I think they're now down to one, but we bought all of our equipment through him. And it's a relationship business in a way that I think is almost endangered now in a lot of companies. So I'm glad to hear that you had that frontline experience and that sounds like our experience with Kim Keel was consistent with other parts of the country.
Well, I know I said this before, but we're so lucky to have your business, Toby, and the business of all of our customers, and we don't take that for granted. And one of the ways that we uphold that commitment to our customers is in everything that we do. Not only the machines that we manufacture, the technologies that we innovate, but the way we express ourselves in the world through things like corporate social responsibility.
Yeah. So give our audience a little bit of an overview first of John Deere, sort of size, either annual sales, employee count, geographic reach, and so forth. And then let's talk a little bit about what corporate social responsibility looks like there.
John Deere is special to all of us who work here. And for those of us who have generations of family members who have worked here, we could go on and on about the company and its history. We're a nearly 200-year-old company. We're global in reach. Today, we have, I think, nearly 85,000 employees worldwide. We're known for our manufacturing of technologies in the fields of agriculture, construction, forestry, and turf. And our purpose... our purpose statement is we run so life can leap forward. And for those of us in the company, that is call to action for serving those who serve these extraordinarily high purposes. Again, our customers feed and clothe and mm-hmm. renewably fuel and house and help transport billions of people mm-hmm. every year. And we take that role very seriously. So that's who we are and what we do.
That's beautiful. Can you say it one more time so we all get it? So run like a deer, right? So
Yeah. So we run so life can leap forward. Mm-hmm. And it's a really powerful statement for us. Again, it is a call to action, this concept of running and producing and competing and innovating, the speed at which that the world demands that from us now is Absolutely. Faster and harder than ever before. But the goal isn't simply that. It isn't just activity. There's progress and human progress at the end. Mm-hmm. And so when we can create value for customers like you, Toby, and when we can make our customers more profitable and productive and sustainable, we know what happens. We have 200 years of experience when we help a farmer and their family grow. Mm-hmm. Not only are they successful and those communities successful, but the world flourishes around them. So that's how we talk about ourselves.
I love it. It's you get it instantly. It makes a lot of sense, and it doesn't sound like malarkey. So how does that then, when you go above and beyond the call of duty with your corporate social responsibility, your philanthropy, your volunteerism, tell us a little bit about CSR, and then in a minute we'll talk about your vision for 2024.
Yeah, you know, being a nearly 200-year-old company, we know what CSR has meant over our full lifespan. One of my colleagues, Laura Eberlin, who is a terrific community engagement expert, she refers to CSR, corporate social responsibility, as a historical artifact that reflects the relationship that John Deere has with the world around it. And that relationship has grown and changed and pivoted over our entire history. Our very founder, John Deere, the person, he started his business here in 1837. It was the same time that Alexis de Tocqueville was talking about the United States and democracy and giving. And John Deere, the person, was known as a raging abolitionist. He started the YMCA. He knew the importance of giving back. It's something that he passed on to his children and other business leaders. We started the American Red Cross here in the Quad Cities, our headquarter community, in 1918. We started food banks in the midst of the farm crisis. And so we know the role and the importance that we play and the inextricable link that we have with many of our stakeholders, our customers, our employees, our neighbors, and so many others. And so as we have grown as a company and changed as a company, our CSR has grown and changed to meet as many of those stakeholder interests as possible.
Well, I also love, as you described, that fantastic history of CSR at John Deere, that your philosophy major comes home to roost, right?
One of the things that I just so appreciate about working at a company like John Deere, a couple of things. The history is lovely. You know, at some point, Toby, if you're ever in the Midwest, we'd love to host you here at our headquarters. We'd love to take you on a tour of the archives because it's a living, breathing museum, not just of John Deere, but sort of America and the growth of America. And it's if you're a history dork like me, you would love it. And so the offer is always open. The other thing that I love about John Deere is we're a learning and thinking company. I mean, not only is that sort of built into the nature of innovation and technology, but we want to do right by the world around us. One of the reasons why my grandmother said, Nate, working for John Deere is as high as you could get, is there's an earnestness in the company. And that earnestness and integrity is a reflection of the fact that we want to do right. We want to do right by the world and the stakeholders around us. And so philosophically, morally, ethically, there is something really powerful about the John Deere story and how it's shown up through our employees and our leaders throughout our history.
But, you know, I hear you and I believe you, but I want to just challenge you because the headwinds now that face any brand with called the three-letter acronyms, the ESG and the DEI. You take this position, but how do you stay honest? How do you deal with the headwinds that come from either side to say, like, you're a snowflake or you're being PC or you're, you know, you're being blue, you're being red? I mean, these are really polarizing times and you're in the heartland. We just had the Republican caucus out there this week. I mean, in a certain sense, are very tough times, but if you know your whole compass, I think they're not, but still, you're on the front lines, I would imagine. I wonder how you help the brand steward that.
Yeah, you know, this is a great question because, I mean, if we talk a little bit about history again, Toby, it's interesting. So I've been doing this job for about 11 years. And I remember, so building on that idea that CSR is a historical artifact, we've seen it grow and change and become more important in the throes of really big global challenges. You saw in the United States the birth of war chests and community chests in the midst of World War I and the Great Depression. You saw the belief that maybe corporations should play a role and the growth of foundations in the 1940s and 50s. Mm-hmm. You see pushback against CSR from Milton Friedman and the like in the early 1970s. Yep. But then you see it grow again as corporations became very big and our influence grew on the heels of the economic recession. And you see it grow and change again in the midst of COVID and after COVID. One of the most important things for any corporation or any CSR department is to understand the role that we play is to help ensure that our business maintains its license to operate. And that license to operate is something that's given to us by all of our stakeholders, including specifically our customers and employees first, but our other stakeholders, including investors and neighbors and others thereafter. And one of the missing pieces in many CSR activity is, do you explain and take the time to understand what they want, these stakeholders value, what they share, and then deliver what they value? And one of the things that we found is we're a research company, a data company, is that we took the step a couple years ago to ask our stakeholders what they valued. And what we found, regardless of political stripe or regardless of demographic differences or age differences, is that when they looked at John Deere and they understood who we were, they said that there were a few things that they saw us as playing a really important role in doing. One of those was strengthening food systems and eliminating hunger. That's really important. That makes sense in light of who we are, what we've done for 1837. We also understood that there was this concept of poverty and the costs that were being carried by marginalized segments of our home communities, regardless of where we are. That was also a call to action. So one of the ways that you avoid perhaps backlash against CSR or questions as to whether you as a company are delivering on your social responsibility is you ask your stakeholders. And that's something that we did. And that continues to be our North Star. In what we do as a business, our North Star is always our customers and our employees. Yeah. And when you ask them how you should show up and they tell you, it's a good idea to answer those calls.
Yeah, I think that's a really great point because there's, they used to call it greenwashing and other things, but I think with these headwinds, it's important to really, you've got to commit. Like if you're going to commit to something, whatever your CSR platform or commitments are, you need to not be seasonal about it. You need to really be baked throughout the culture and everyone needs to be largely on board with it because there's turbulent times for sure ahead.
You mentioned something really important and that concept of greenwashing. We take that really seriously. When we talk about corporate social responsibility, I view that as the big umbrella. And in fact, if you again, calling it on a bit of history, there was a book written by an Iowan by the name of Howard Bowen. It's The Social Responsibilities of the Businessman. It was published in 1953. And it's a really great piece for Iowans. He was the president of Grinnell College, where my son graduated from his undergrad. He eventually became the president of the University of Iowa, the school where actually five generations of us have gone. And he talks about in this book what social responsibility is, and it's everything. It is how you show up with your employees and customers. It's what you do environmentally with your neighbors and your neighborhoods. One of the pieces that has remained true for the entire history of CSR is you must be true to your stakeholders. And there are times at which winds of change can pull people to follow ideas that might not be true to their purpose, might be true to their stakeholders. And that has bred a lot of cynicism about corporate social responsibility, a lot of really quite just criticism that there is perhaps CSR that is more of a veneer. It's not true. People aren't driving for outcomes. They might be driving for something less substantial. And 200 years has told us that you have to focus on the why and what you produce to be trusted.
Agreed. I mean, I often talk about the concept of reputational currency, and whether you're a brand or an individual, you have a reputation and you either manage it and maintain it and treat it seriously. And when you make mistakes, you own it. But I think it's important to think that way because we are living in complex times. Again, ladies and gentlemen, today we're really happy on the Caring Economy to have as our guest, Nate Clark. He's the Global Director of Corporate Social Responsibility and the President of the John Deere Foundation. So I know from, I think, your annual report, you've had in your 75 years with the foundation, more than $400 million in contributions to access to nutrition, shelter, education. Are those themes pretty much the manifestation of what you've just described? Are those the main areas that you would typically be seeing John Deere employees, volunteers, and dollars going out?
Yeah, so I think we have a really special blend of how we give. When it comes to our direct grant making from the John Deere Foundation, we invest in those things, those causes, those organizations, those nonprofit professionals who are delivering transformational and fundamental impact. For us, it always starts with food. For those of us who grow up in the Midwest, we often call upon Dr. Norman Borlaug, the father of the Green Revolution. And for Dr. Borlaug, the first element of social justice was always adequate access to food. So we think a lot about that. But we don't just think about food. We think about food and education. We think food and self-sufficiency and economic empowerment. So we think a lot about that. We also, having learned a great deal from wonderful nonprofit experts, many of whom you've had on your podcast, we also know that at the core of this idea of development is human dignity and placing the most marginalized within our home communities first. So we think a lot about that. So that's where we direct our direct grant making. As it relates to our employees, because they're such an amazing group of people who are all philanthropically and volunteerism minded, We have created an employee giving program that is quite open. We reward employees and their giving and their volunteerism quite broadly, regardless of the cause they support. On the one hand, we know the engagement impact that means, and also we learn from these causes that we see them donating to or volunteering for. So to give you a sense of scale, when I started with the John Deere Foundation about a decade ago, we were matching about $400,000 or $500,000 a year in donations, employee donations and volunteerism. Mm-hmm. This year, it'll be about $10 million.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yes, we have it. We have our cake and eat it too. We have a really focused strategy on marginalized people within our home communities and marginalized farmers. And then we have this open program that really leverages the passion and power and purpose of our employees.
And can you say, what about actual volunteerism? Do you have, do you organize programs? Do you encourage by giving time off for employees to go out and do things? Or how do employees volunteer across the organization?
Yeah, so we try to embrace volunteerism and promote volunteerism in its many forms. Employees have the opportunity to take paid time off according to the needs of the business to volunteer during the workday. We also provide for volunteerism $20 per hour of volunteerism for Dollars for Doers credit, which is a great incentive. And we see employees recording time for things that we support, like food banks and for educational programs. But we also see a whole host of things like volunteer firefighters and sports coaches. And so we try to deliver funds in ways that incent them when they're outside the work time. The other thing that's important here as part of our journey is I think we have become more mindful of the ways we work with nonprofit organizations. And we are extremely mindful that sometimes if we create volunteer events, those might be not particularly helpful for the nonprofit organizations, or they may be, to be a bit critical, they might be performative. And mm-hmm. so we have stepped away from big days of action or on-site volunteer events in an effort to allow employees in smaller groups or personally to become better connected with the nonprofit organizations they serve. Yeah. So we've been thinking, we have learned from the Voulez of the world and the Dan Pilatas that nonprofit organizations don't serve us, but we serve them. And we try to be mindful of that in everything we do.
That's really helpful. I'll talk to you more after the interview about something I'm in the mix with now around that volunteerism thing. But I think of this as another example where things are perhaps changing. I'd love to get your take, Nate, on some of the bigger trends in CSR. I think there has been a movement, a necessary one, away from performative volunteerism. Get the t-shirt and a bag of stuff that you don't need, and then you go back after a day out. Right? Feels good for a moment, but the real change isn't going to happen there. And I wonder, aside from that, kind of the where volunteerism might go, are there any other big trends you're seeing across the with your peers from other companies across either the US or around the world in terms of, you know, is in-kind up, is our sabbaticals growing in commonplace happening, or any sort of meta themes you're seeing around CSR?
Yes. Well, I think the discussion around trust-based philanthropy has been really an inspiration. And we had mentioned before your interview with
Darren Walker. Yeah.
Darren, yeah, from Ford Foundation. I'm just thinking there have been so many leaders who have shined a light on harmful practices of philanthropy and the cost of that, particularly in delivering what businesses always want and CSR has always want, which is impact. Mm-hmm. And so I see more of my peers being attentive to the needs of nonprofit organizations and being less restrictive. We see it less restrictive in terms of grant making. We, over the last few years, have transitioned the vast majority of all of our grants to unrestricted and multi-year grants. Cool. And we are becoming less imposing in terms of grant applications and expectations of reporting or volunteer events. And we're trying to learn through the eyes and expertise of nonprofits about the challenges the world faces. And so we are, again, a learning company we learn from our customers, we learn from our dealers. We should also learn from the nonprofit professionals and other experts about some of the biggest challenges the world faces. Nonprofits sit in this void where business and government isn't working. Mm-hmm. And we depend upon them for the prosperity of the communities that we call home.
Yeah, I think that's inspiring to hear you say that. And I'd like to believe that's the case as well. So one last question, what AI might be looking like over at John Deere?
One of the things that's special about John Deere is we're always mindful of how we can leverage technology for the benefit of the people that we serve. And our journey in corporate social responsibility has also been a technology-driven one. For example, we benefited enormously from using technology to improve our grant-making processes and our employee giving. It was through technology and alleviating the burden and the energy required in managing grants through paper forms and paper pledge forms and all the things that used to be the trappings of old CSR. It allowed us to dedicate our energy more toward impact and working with our partners in a more substantive way. We see other technologies, including AI, as ways to better understand and gain access to and synthesize information that we now have at our fingertips. It's not only us as a donor, but we see nonprofit organizations leveraging a whole host of technologies that will allow them to better understand their impacts, better connect with their stakeholders, and build better connections with donors. And so just as in the business, we see a whole host of technologies, including AI, helping us serve our customers, we believe it's going to help us better serve the communities that we call home.
So cool. I've taught three courses now in AI for social impact, and I find it incredibly helpful in terms of collaboration and creativity. If you're further along in your career as you are, as I am, we know our network, we know what we know, we know how to, I think, use the tool more effectively, and thereby free up time from the more mundane things to just really do more collaborating and creating.
Yeah, I think we have a really strong belief that technologies like AI will allow us to be not only more productive and allow us to get a jump start on creativity, allow us to take in a world of information that would have been hard for us to process before. And at the same time, it will also allow us to have a greater well-being, greater flexibility that we can spend our energy, which is so limited, on the things of the highest importance, and then also spend more time on things like rest, which are equally important.
Absolutely. Even the running deer has to rest.
Indeed.
Nate, just one last question. We always conclude by asking our guests if they have any pearls of wisdom or lessons learned in their career, in their life, broadly about leading a purpose-driven life or a purpose-driven career, but it can be any sort of advice you might have for young and old alike about success and finding it.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. And I don't know if anyone's ever asked me that question in that way. So I appreciate it. I don't know if these will be pearls, but for me, in terms of purpose, I'm very lucky to work for a company that embodies purpose. Who we serve, it's growers, again, it's construction contractors, it's loggers. These people, these businesses, these families serve such an important role that it's very humbling to know that we play a small part in their success. And so finding purpose and finding a business or something is possible. I was able to do it. At the same time, purpose is something that you can create. And it's not just something that you have to search for, that you can build in yourself as you learn and you grow. Mm-hmm. And in my work, one of the things that I developed was a purpose for being a really trusted partner and colleague and kind and considered humane. That growth, that purpose is something that I developed. And so I think it's something that you find, and it's something that you can develop and bring with you.
Mm-hmm. I love that, sort of nurture and nature, right? We all have it. We should be waiting for someone else to find our purpose or talents. You know?
Exactly.
We all do a little bit of work as well as, you know, take what's ours. So Nate Clark, the head of CSR at John Deere and the president of the John Deere Foundation, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on The Caring Economy. And I hope you'll come back. I want to hear what not only does Vision 2024 look like, but how it ended and then what 2025 holds.
Thanks, Toby. And again, the offer still stands. Maybe the next time that we talk, we can host you here in Moline.
Thank you for listening to The Caring Economy with Toby Usnick. Please share your comments and questions with Toby via Twitter at TUsnick or LinkedIn at Toby Usnick. And thank you for sharing The Caring Economy with your friends and colleagues.